Okay, good. So, last time a few people were present, but we actually covered a very important part, in fact, the central part of this entire chapter, the culminating paragraphs. And the first paragraph, the long paragraph that began the reading last time, which was, I'll tell you what page that was. It was page 370 in the PDF version. It begins again, "If we remain absorbed in the silence." So I draw your attention to that. It's something that I'd suggest you all read for yourself, and I'll just draw your attention to one or two things in that paragraph, because that is where he's pointing to the equivalence of these three double principles and showing how they work from the transcendence into the phenomenal ignorance. So in fact, there are three levels that one can talk of in which these principles are at work. The transcendent, in which Brahman and Maya are at work, and they seem to be two independent infinities, which is actually the same being. Brahman and Sri Aurobindo, we discussed this earlier, terms them elsewhere, the passive Brahman and the active Brahman. And they represent, from a sense, the unmanifest infinity of the unknowable, and the deployment of the possibilities of that unknowable in terms of conscious force, which acts upon that and in relation to it brings out its potencies. Transcendent duality, which is absolute infinity, gazing at absolute infinity, the reflexiveness of the absolute, is then turned into a cosmic reality, which is at the level of supermind and overmind, where we find the Ishvara Shakti relationship. That is being mobilized, the what is coming out of the unknowable is then mobilized through the real idea of supermind into a certain kind of logic, you may say, an idea that is being unfolded. And that is unfolded firstly as tapas of Ishvara, and secondly as the executive workings of Shakti. The tapas of Ishvara is producing the executive workings of Shakti. And then this working of Shakti actually creates a certain succession of manifestation, and this succession of manifestation is bringing the Ishvara into a space-time frame and manifesting the real idea of the Ishvara in terms of an unfoldment, in which the Ishvara seems to be absent, but is actually present within and latent in the movements of the Prakriti. So Purusha is carried in the movements of Prakriti. And Sri Aurobindo is pointing out how we can approach this reality, this double reality, which is, manifesting itself through three bends, almost like a tribhanga. It's like a triple status which is refracted through each layer down into the evolving ignorance. And the two ways in which we can approach this, he points out, that have been the ways in which we approach this. One is to look at it as Brahman, and that is the Vedantic method, and particularly the Advaitic method, where the idea is that there is a single undivided being, and whatever we are experiencing in the phenomenal reality is an illusion, and we have to get out of that into that single undivided being. So he points out that that particular approach to the reality is going to, sort of erase for us our meaning, the meaning of the cosmos and the meaning of our own existence, or of others, the existence of others, other entities. On the other hand, he's saying the theistic schools look upon this reality as a god. And, you know, this god is, either you can give it a name, Vishnu, Shiva, whatever, this supreme personality or supreme person, and that Saguna, Brahman, also carries a problem, because in a similar way we have now related ourselves to some supreme king, a kind of overlord, Parameshwara. And in that we have also in a different way lost the link that unites us with that. We have become sort of separated, and if that is connected with us through some kind of power that includes everything, that puts everything in its place and mobilizes the time sequences of, and space sequences of the cosmos, then we don't have any grasp over that. What we have a grasp over is this Lord who we implicitly assume controls everything, the overruler and controller of everything. And so we have lost, in that case, the entire time movement as a reality. It becomes implicit, but its reality becomes occluded from our relationship. Now, the third approach is to look at that reality as our primary door of relationship. In other words, instead of the becoming, we see instead of the being, we look at the becoming and try to find the being who is the being of the becoming. Who is the being of the becoming? The being of the becoming is the Shakti. And it is indeed Shakti of the Ishvara Shakti formulation who is the manifestation of the tapas of Ishvara, who then gives birth to the Ishvara in all the movements of its own self-becoming. So we can say the entire cosmos is a time movement. It is a process. And that process is the very body of the Divine Mother. And in that process, all the entities that are contained are actually carrying within them the Divine Purusha or the Divine Ishvara. So she has given birth to herself as well as to the Ishvara as the manifestation. This is one of the points he makes there. The point that particularly in the manifest end of things, I read in the superconscient truth of the self-existence, these two are fused and implied in each other, one and indistinguishable. But in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. This is at the cosmic level. The Divine Mother Energy as the universal creatrix, Maya, Para, Prakriti, Chit Shakti, manifests the cosmic self and Ishvara and her own self power as a dual principle. So she gives, as it were, manifestation to both the Ishvara as well as herself as the dual principle. It is through her that the being, the self, the Ishvara acts, and he does nothing except by her. Though his will is implicit in her, it is she who works out all as the supreme consciousness force who holds all souls and beings within her and as her executive nature. All exists and acts according to nature, all is the consciousness force, manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which he casts his existence. This last part of the sentence actually reads like something from the book The Mother. And indeed, what he's saying over there is that if we are to give true value to the being of the becoming, the one who is actually carrying out this manifestation, the will or the tapas of Ishvara as the manifestation, then it is the Shakti, the Divine Mother, to whom we have to make our approach. That is the point of approach. Because indeed, that gives full value to the becoming as a single cosmic becoming, plus the becoming of every individual entity in that becoming, including oneself. Who am I? What is my reality as a form of becoming? What is that reality in relation to other forms of becoming and to the entire cosmic becoming seen as a single becoming? Who controls all this and coordinates all this? It is the Divine Mother. And it is therefore by approaching her that we keep this particular aspect of the manifestation intact and make it the sole and most prominent power that we must give full value to for our progress into an integral consciousness, into a consciousness in which Ishvara and Shakti become self-manifest in the cosmos. This is the why he ends that passage by saying, all exists and acts according to nature. All is the consciousness force manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which he casts his existence. If we draw back from her workings, then all can fall into quiescence and we can enter into the silence, because she consents to cease from her dynamic activity. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. If we would affirm our independence of nature, she reveals to us the supreme and omnipresent power of the Ishvara and ourselves as beings of his being. But that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. If we would realize a higher formation or status of being, this would be a status above the ignorance, a status of truth manifestation, a supramental manifestation. Even there, it is still through the divine Shakti, the consciousness force of the spirit, that it has to be done. Then comes the key part. Our surrender must be to the divine being through the divine mother. For it is towards or into the supreme nature that our ascension has to take place, and it can only be done by the supramental Shakti taking up our mentality and transforming it into her supramentality. So this is the key part of that particular paragraph, which is perhaps the most important paragraph in this entire chapter. And so that's what I wanted to draw to your attention. For the rest, what we studied are the next few paragraphs. And in those paragraphs, essentially he's going back to the dualities that he has introduced, and he's pointing out how those dualities are resolved once we look at it like this. So first we find that he talks about, the problem of using intellectual language
which creates too heavy an outline to everything, which falsifies the subtlety of their truths. And this is why we seem to think or feel that these realities are distinct philosophical entities, when it is just one reality, and yet it perceives itself in these different statuses and aspects of being. Then he talks about the one and the many. How do we resolve the one and the many? And he points out how the many, in the case of each individual, has the one within it, because the one has become each person, and yet it is in and through our nature that we are related to the one as a portion of the one. And that also needs to be affirmed, both the identity and the relationship of the many to the one as a relationship of amsa, sanatana, eternal portion to the whole, as well as in a way a self-perception of the whole. These two need to be affirmed. And finally, the final paragraph, he looks at the non-manifest and manifestation and points out that these are not two different things, but the non-manifest is non-manifest because the manifestation is a dimensionality of its self-perception. And through that dimension, it is manifest. But what is manifesting is not other than what is manifest. And that's the point that he makes there regarding the self-power of the one, and the fact that it may include a lot more than anything that we know or see, but that it isn't, as a result, something that is completely alien to what our experience brings us. So I think that's the point. If anybody wishes to make comments or ask questions, you may do so, and then we can go on to the next few paragraphs, which take up, these are the final paragraphs, which take up the nature of the conditions of the manifestation, which are time and space.
Devasa, could you repeat once more the page number?
Page number of which one?
The PDF.
The page number of the PDF starting today is 375.
Okay, thank you.
The paragraph beginning the original status.
Sure.
Debashish, could I ask a question about the unmanifest and the manifest?
Okay, yes, Olga.
I'm just looking at it now, but I'm not sure I fully understand what is being said there. That what's in the timeless unmanifested is implied and appears in time and movement. Could you say more about that? I'm not sure what my question is, because I'm just not quite coming to grips with it.
Well, what he's saying is that if reality is radically infinite, there's always going to be an infinite amount of it that will remain unmanifest. And hence, it's beyond every possibility of knowledge. In other words, if we turn the gaze of knowledge upon this radical infinity, there will always be infinite amount of it that will remain beyond any possibility of knowledge. So this is sort of like the zero of the nirvana. In other words, it's a passage into the unknowable,
So a passage which occurs through a certain void. And since it's completely, sort of beyond, it has a dimension of complete unknowability, which is beyond whatever we can imagine, then it couldn't actually have any relationship or any similarity or familiarity with what we experience in the manifestation. And so is it something that we have to completely get out of the manifestation to experience? This question becomes important if we try to decide what is desirable, what is the primary goal to be achieved. Is the primary goal to be achieved to enter into an experience of the Absolute? And if so, is that experience of the Absolute completely different from whatever it is that we experience in the relative world, the world of the manifestation? And what he's saying is that they're not two different things. It is this radical infinity that is also self-perceiving itself as the manifestation. And if something in it is not manifest here and now, that doesn't mean it will not manifest. That in effect, whatever is manifest is also manifesting from that unknowable. And hence, it is included in the unknowable. And so, we should affirm not merely the unknowable, but also the unknown and the known. The manifestation itself is the carrier of that particular unknowable, which stands as its backdrop and enters into it, deploying its own sequences forever, you may say, in a time eternity. Timeless eternal is experiencing itself in a time eternity. It's just another matter of dimension. It's not two different things. That's the point he's making.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a lot clearer for me.
Okay.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Margaret, would you like to go first?
Okay. The original status is that of the reality timeless and spaceless. Space and time would be the same reality self-extended to contain the deployment of what was within it. The difference would be, as in all the other oppositions, the spirit looking at itself in essence and principle of being, and the same spirit looking at itself in the dynamism of its essence and principle. Space and time are our names for this self-extension of the one reality. We are apt to see space as a static extension in which all things stand or move together in a fixed order. We see time as a mobile extension, which is measured by movement and event. Space then would be Brahman in self-extended status. Time would be Brahman in self-extended movement. But this may be only a first view and inaccurate. Space may be really a constant mobile. The constancy and the persistent time relation of things in its creating the sense of stability of space. The mobility creating the sense of time movement in stable space. Or again, space would be Brahman, extended for the holding together of forms and objects. Time would be Brahman, self-extended for the deployment of the movement of self-power, carrying forms and objects. The two would then be a dual aspect of one and the same self-extension of the cosmic eternal.
So here he's entering into a discussion of time and space, because as he pointed out earlier, the paragraph before this, where he's talking about the non-manifest and the manifest, it is indeed the non-manifest is just a spaceless and timeless reality, but the manifest is a certain kind of dimension of self-perception in which time and space form the basic fundamental the categories through which the self experience is taking place. And so what is time and space is what he's asking over here, and he's looking at it from a variety of directions, because indeed if we are to give full value to the manifestation, it is a manifestation within time and space. And so time and space, in a sense, are the body of the becoming. It is the body of the mother itself. And how is this related to the absolute? And he's talking about how that which is absolute to express or manifest itself, it needs to create a container, an infinite container, within which its possibilities will be given a certain kind of space. It will be given a certain type of canvas on which they will be given reality, granted reality. And time similarly would be a certain principle by which that granting of reality would be sequential. There would be a certain kind of a progression to it. So that's how he talks about space and time as the same reality self-extended to contain the deployment of what was within it. And then he says, what is, the spaceless and timeless, and what is the time and space or space-time reality are two ways of self-perception of the same being. The spirit looking at itself in essence and principle of being, that is just the static gaze upon its own essence, would be one way of looking at it. And the other one is to look at it as a dynamism of its essence and principle. So again, what is its power, creative power? And how can it, get to know itself in a becoming? These are the two ways in which it can look at itself, and that is one as the original absolute self-perception, and the other as the self-perception as cosmos. So we find that these two are just two kinds of self-perception. And then he goes further to revisit space and time as the names of this self-extension of the one reality. So this, the names of this self-extension, this single dimension with which the manifestation becomes the manifestation of the absolute, and within it the two dimensions of space and time which form the self-extension. He says we are apt to see space as a static extension, and then he questions that in which all things stand or move together in a fixed order. In other words, even if they're moving, it's basically contained within that space. In the same space, all the movement is taking place. And then time, on the other hand, is a mobile extension which is measured by movement and event. And then he's saying, therefore, these are also Brahman. These are just as Brahman has become all the entities. Before becoming the entities, it has to become the condition under which entities can exist and relate to one another as a cosmos.
And those conditions are the conditions of space and time. So Brahman has first to become a certain dimension, which is the dimension of self-extended status and the dimension of self-extended movement. So those are the self creations of Brahman within which the entities can exist and progress. But as he says, this may be only a first view. So he's taking an alternative view of what he's talking about. So here he's pointing out that instead of looking at space as a static envelope or container, space itself may be mobile. In other words, he's complicating the issue by looking at space and time as entangled. Space may be really a constant mobile. It's the sense of something constant coming from the fact that it is constantly moving. Its constancy is what is giving it the sense of something which is constant. The constancy and persistent time relation of things in it creating the sense of stability or space, and the mobility creating the sense of time movement. Here, in this kind of understanding, we're seeing that time and space are inextricably bound, and that time is also a form of space, just as space is a form of time, in a way. And then he's looking at another possibility, that space is Brahman extended for the holding together of forms and objects, and time is Brahman self-extended for the deployment of the movement of self-power. In other words, they come after. The first one is they become the transcendental conditions, as Kant saw it, the Kantian transcendental conditions for the existence of a cosmos. And in this case, the third case, they become the consequence of the existence of entities. So, carrying the forms and objects. The two would then be a dual aspect of one and the same self-extension of the cosmic eternal. That it is really the self-born power of manifestation that includes these two in a kind of, two different ways of looking at the same thing. And so we find that space and time are also resolved as forms of Brahman, and ultimately one form of Brahman, and ultimately Brahman itself.
I am thinking just in terms of light, that there is an issue. If you look from, science point of view, that the communication is something which gives us the sense of space and time. There's the communication mostly measured by electromagnetic signals, which, you can think of light, for example. So this communication also takes a part into this entire fabrication of space and time, which is why, even the problem of, the abstruseness of relativity comes in, which actually, sort of overwhelms eludes our mind with the notion of constancy of speed of light and its finitude at the same time. So, do you think this is something which we can think of in this aspect?
I completely agree that is a very important aspect of, or one of the ways, just as he's looking at the reality of space and time from different directions and showing different, views of the same thing and ultimately seeing them as entangled and also as being the same thing, Brahman as doubly perceived. I think to look at them as emerging
as a consequence of communication is also a very valid way of looking at it. And I think we have to understand that why he's taking these things up is to give us an intuition into the workings of the mother, of the Shakti. Because ultimately the entire Shakti is the container and the process. Shakti is space and time. Space and time are the body of the Shakti. But within the Shakti, the entities that are being held by that space and that are experiencing progression of time are also entities that are related. We can look at the relationality as primary. If we look at the relationality as primary, it is the communication which becomes that which gives reality to the space and time. And so I think from that is also a very important point, because the surrender to the Shakti that he's talking about is particularly related to all these aspects. One aspect is that we are related to the entire cosmos. That is part of the body of the mother. We are related to the evolution in the cosmos. That is related to the time aspect of the mother. We are related to every other entity in the cosmos, living, present, and past, and future. And it is indeed that communication between all these entities that is another way of looking at the reality of the Shakti. And I think these are all very valid ways of thinking about space and time. We will also see as we go on that he is going to talk about this existence of space and time at different levels, that there is a material or physical space and time, but then there is a mental space and time and a spiritual space and time. The properties and the relations of the two at each of these levels are not the same, but nevertheless they are all self-manifestations of Brahman.
Devashish?
Yes.
Does he get into the Shakti element more and delineating between perhaps any masculine and feminine elements of when it comes to space and time? Or
not really. I mean, are you saying whether space and time themselves have a masculine and feminine element to it?
You may
look at it like that, because note that he points out that in terms of masculine and feminine, if we go back to the Ishvara and Shakti, as he's saying over there, this is the basis of the polarity of the cosmos, the masculine and feminine truth of the cosmos. Then he's pointing out that it is the Shakti, the female, that actually gives birth to the male and the female. In going down from the transcendent into the cosmos, it is the power of the transcendent that then gives birth to both the male and the female. And so it is this that he's talking about here. And if we look upon space and time from that point of view, we can call space as male and time as female. But they are being given birth by the female. Both of them are aspects of the birthing of the Brahman by its own Shakti or its power.
Yeah, I just kind of had an intuition, and I was kind of thinking in terms of space, because it can be more described in many respects as material, right? Everything that's in space is, you know, whether you can see it or whether if it's dark matter, which I guess still has form, still has substance on some level. I tended to think of all material matter as the mother. And that's why I kind of was equating space in my own mind with the mother. But, you know, I...
Well, space would be an objective condition. The condition for objectivity, it wouldn't even be objectivity. It wouldn't be entities. It wouldn't be matter. It would be the condition for matter to exist. It would be self-extension, as he says over there. So from the point of view of self-extension, if we can think of an infinitely spread out consciousness that is static, and he's complicating the fact by pointing out that it may not be static, because it the idea of it being static is also a certain kind of perception which we have separated. And if we don't separate it, we see that its staticness is really an appearance. But on the other hand, if we do see it like that, if we do see the provisional division of reality into time and space, then we can see space as a self-extension that is static, and time as a kind of, as he says over there, a self-manifestation that is dynamic. And so the dynamic, the body of the becoming, is the mother. And or is the female, and the static witness, the condition of witnessing, is the holding of all entities, whether physical, mental, or whatever. And from that point, that would be the Ishvara or Purusha.
Ah, thank you.
Sure.
Debashish.
Yeah.
I have a follow-on question to that.
Yes,
the whole question about gender, that Purusha is he and or the Ishwara is he and Shakti is she, and I just don't get it at all. Like, why is that? Because it doesn't seem to have any relation at all with the roles of women and men. And so why is that? Because, you know, like in China, the yang is the dominant, the active, the fiery, and the yin is passive and, you know, and receptive and quiet. And, you know, now with all the gender roles just completely disappearing, and with the evolution of the superhuman form into something that's, you know, neither masculine or feminine, this business of masculine and feminine in the divine seems confusing to me.
Yeah, Linda, actually, if you look at the writings of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, Sri Aurobindo seems to be affirming the fact that there is a truth to this gendered reality. It's there in this very paragraph that we just read. So first, I'd like to draw your attention to that, where he is pointing to the fact that here in this paragraph, where he's saying, if we look again more largely and take account of both the impersonal and the personal truth of things as one truth, if in that light, the light of personality and impersonality, we see the biune aspect of self and self-power, then in the person aspect, a dual person emerges, Ishvara Shakti, the divine self and creator, and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. There becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles, whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. So he seems to be pointing to that. And then even in his correspondence, he says that, this gendered reality is not going to completely disappear. Its nature will change, but it is not going to disappear in the supramental creation. So that's how he puts it. Now, what we experience as gender in our world and in our reality may be a very poor distortion of the principles of the male and the female, that is the truth of the spiritual reality. And therefore, we are finding ourselves in a kind of a difficult situation understanding that. But And the other side of it is, if we look at the mother's writing, there is a place where somebody asks her about this, about, you know, Purusha and Prakriti being male and female and which one is which. And there she says, you know, this is all the construction of some male-dominated society. That, you know, they're actually making one superior and the other inferior and all that, but that's not really how it all is. But even there, she's not really saying that the truth of gender is completely to be negated. You know, Tantra, and what he's talking about here is the privileging of the power of Shakti. Tantra does the same. So the superiority-inferiority business may be relative, and that may be culturally conditioned. But as such, and also our understanding of the sexed nature of humanity or animality may be a far distortion of this truth. But as he points out, there is a truth there, a truth of manifestation that has actually reflected itself in nature through what we see as the genders. So we have to look at it, not understand this, the sort of higher by the lower, but assume that the lower is a certain kind of distorted manifestation of the higher.
Okay, so I've got a quote from the mother where she clearly denies it. Can I read it, or do we want to go on?
Sure. Do read it, Linda.
Okay. So mother says, I've had very clearly the experience of a witness looking at things completely detached, who knows all and does not move, which allows everything to be done. I've also had the experience of a will which decides. But as for making a clear-cut division in this way and calling one masculine and the other feminine, no, I refuse to do that. I have always objected to it and shall always object. This is something that comes from a masculine mentality that's a bit warped. What I object to is the male element and the female element. I find it is not true, and I shall always say it is not true. There's an element like this and another like that, and so forth and so on. But why the devil do you want one to be masculine and the other feminine? It's not true. And then she goes on at the very end. She says, this is a conception which has come from below, has come out of man's brain that cannot think otherwise than of man and woman. I have always felt this. I've said this from the beginning and will repeat it to the end. And if you don't want to hear me say so, don't speak to me about it. And then she laughs. So, you know, she's saying that there is a witness and there is an action, but that she doesn't agree with calling them masculine and feminine. So, you know, and that seems to contradict what Sri Aurobindo is saying, which, you know, is a little bit of a question mark, in my mind anyway.
Linda, actually that what you just read is what I was referring to. I've read that. And indeed. So, you know, we can call it whatever you want. I mean, evidently Sri Aurobindo is talking about it in a certain way. And she wants not to affirm that reality of male and female, because there are severe problems with it when we look at it from our point of view. And, you know, as she's pointing out, these are the creations from below and from, you know, a male-dominated society. And if we want to kind of throw out the idea of male and female, that's fine, but it still remains that there is a relationship, and that relationship is between two poles. It's not just witness and will. It's more than that. It's it's Sri Aurobindo and the mother, for heaven's sake. You know, it's also whatever the Ishvara and Shakti is not just witness and will. It's actually the power that witness and will is only at the mind level. It's the power that formulates the will and the execution of that will. And so these are two. Whether we call it male or female doesn't matter at all. And we may not be the kind of males and females that we are at this point. But nevertheless, a certain kind of relationship between two polarities is the truth of the universe, and call it what you will.
Debashish?
Yeah.
And isn't the larger... Sorry, there's a little bit of feedback. I hope you can hear me okay.
Sure, I can hear you.
Okay. Isn't the larger point that the Ishvara and the Shakti are within everyone, and that it's that polarity or that relationship is not, it's like, you know, what Sri Aurobindo wrote about, I think wrote about the caste system, that the ultimately the caste system, every person has the Brahman and every person has the Karikshetra and all of those within themselves, but we kind of looked at it from a very materialistic and anthropomorphic view, and you know, and literal, but isn't the larger point that we all have male and female, masculine Isvara Shakti within us, and that's the you know, obviously females are a lot of times going to be more carrying more of the Shakti energy, but bringing them into balance in some respects or some regard.
Yeah, no doubt. Everybody has everything in them, and you know, like you talked about the caste system, the qualities of Ishvara and Shakti are present in everybody. Absolutely, there's no doubt about that, and it's also possible that what we call gender has very little to do with it. A male may have much more Shakti than another woman. Woman may have a lot more, you know, Ishvara quality, for that matter.
Right.
But I think what is being talked about is in the manifestation, there is a certain kind of, you know, what he uses the term, the unequal distribution of force. It's entirely equal amount of Brahman, the entire Brahman is present in each entity. But in the manifestation of the entity, it is a certain combination of qualities that goes out, which is the mask worn by the one. There is only one, but that one wears many different masks in which it actually deploys a certain combination of qualities. And that is what makes things different and the play of things possible. And behind all that multiplicity, there is ultimately two who are at play with one another.
Hmm.
Well, thank you, Debashish. Thank you.
Sure.
Devashish, on the same point, can we say that what, when you say that our understanding of gender is not really accurate, can we say that that's because our understanding of gender is based on the physical and the emotional?
Yeah, absolutely. It's based on the physical and the emotional, and it's based on the whole history of human gender. Gender is a construct. It's a construct and a discourse that has actually been understood by human beings in different ways throughout different cultures. But ultimately, there are great similarities in that. And we have created worlds which may have been female-dominated and one were at one time and are male-dominated at other times. But you're right that those are due to limitation of our understanding of these roles or of these genders that are tied to the body and to the emotions.
Devashish?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Dan Harris has written something which he sent as a chat, which is relevant, and he's making the distinction. He says, I think sex is the physical attribute and gender is the psychological attribute. Yeah, quite. And also there is a social attribute which is part of the discursive understanding of gender as it has come to us in history and as we deploy it in our everyday relations.
It is interesting that, I mean, we're physically either male or female, but that could also be understood as no different to hair color. It's just that we choose to make it remarkably different.
Yeah, that is part of the construct over there, you know, and we nature has also geared it in that manner. And again, human beings are a very peculiar, you know, manifestation of nature because our self-willed kind of quality makes us challenge the fixed grooves of nature. And yet we also contain these grooves, and hence it is the animal understanding of sex and gender that it translates into our lives as well. And then we complicate that with other understandings that we are legitimately given to do because of our special quality as human beings.
So Devashish, is Sri Aurobindo saying that we should take gender on a higher mode, and that this is, and that he's giving us that higher mode?
Well, what he's doing is he's telling us that there is a certain origin to the idea of gender, that this, or you may call it polarity if you want to take it out of living things, because Brahman is not just, Brahman is consciousness itself, and it's conscious, but that does not mean that it is only living creatures. Without taking any form, it can be fully conscious. So what he's saying is that for any manifestation of Brahman, this principle of polarity is needed. And we can talk about it as a principle of gender. But, you know, that is something which gives the symbolical reality to what we experience as gender in the world, but that does not need to limit itself to what we know as gender.
Thank you.
Devashish, I had one tiny little last question.
Sure.
Why would one consider men not to be active and women to be active? It just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, let's go with the mother and say it has nothing to do with men and women, okay?
Yeah.
But what he's trying to say over here is that neither man is not, let's take it out of men and women, but let's talk about what he's calling the masculine and feminine principles of Brahman. And if we talk about masculine and feminine principles of Brahman, neither of them is inactive. The masculine principle concentrates its will in essence, and the feminine principle becomes the creative, you know, kind of setting into motion of that will. So both of them are active. Without that creative principle, without that massing of energy in the idea, that enters into a certain kind of manifestation, there wouldn't be any manifestation. So both of them are active,
sure.
And both of them from a certain point of view are the same. One seems to be doing an essential act, but the other is the temporal unfolding of that act. So that is what you know, he's talking about.
Yeah, I understand the what you're saying there about the principles of action. I was still just wondering why one was considered masculine and one was considered feminine. But I think we can just leave it that I don't quite get it and move on.
Yeah. Actually, there, you know, I mean, if you really think about it, I mean, it's not that one is superior and one is inferior or anything like that. And also, it may... The origin of these principles may have nothing to do with male and female as we physically or even maybe psychologically understand it at our level. But nevertheless, one must be one. You know, there must be, you call this one female and that one male, or that one female and this one male. I mean, eventually it does boil down to one or the other. And basically what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that, you know, these are the two principles and they have these two qualities. And, you know, that is, I mean, he's not saying that he is saying that what is being called Ishvara is the masculine principle and what is being called Shakti is the feminine principle. But, yeah, once we just allow for those properties, they're actually not, they're included in each other. I mean, that's why he's saying they're indistinguishable in the transcendent, and they only become distinguishable as dimensions, just as space and time are dimensions. And you may ask the question, why is space extension and why is time dynamic? Well, that's the way they are. You can just flip the names around, it's not going to change anything.
Yeah, I'm not questioning any of that.
Yeah.
I see all that, yeah.
Just a quick thing, just to feel like expressing that. You know, when I had this question, I don't know whether it is correct way or not, I somehow felt it... I mean, it made sense to me that when I could think of the Sat, Chit, and Ananda as Sat as the as that male principle, and the Chit is the female principle, and the Ananda is the relationship. I don't know if it makes sense, but somehow it made me feel as if it's making sense.
Devashish?
Yeah.
And that Sat Chit Ananda relationship is fulfilled within ourselves and doesn't necessarily take another woman or another man to make that happen.
Yeah.
Which is what I was referring to before.
I agree.
And I think that, you know, if you're looking at which one is more powerful or trying to place it on some kind of a hierarchy, if you're a man, well, from a male's perspective, let me just tell you, you know, half the men I know and my own self, you might say, if I might, a little self-disclosure perhaps, but most of the men I know are looking for that female quality pretty seriously. And I don't think that they happen to think that the male or masculine aspect, which may be predominant within them, is more superior. But anyway, that's just from a guy's perspective.
Yeah, no, as I said, I mean, we can look at it in whatever way we want, but I mean, there may be other ways of understanding this. Both the principles are present in each person, yes, and both and the relationship between human beings may include any variety of ways of relating to others in terms of these principles. It does not mean that if somebody is sexually gendered as a male or a female, that one or the other is going to be the principal way of relating to that person.
What do you think in Sri Aurobindo's writings is the best meditation on these male and female principles as they relate to ourselves, within ourselves?
I think the primary one is to see them as occurring within us and to experience them as occurring within us. And whatever relations emerge are guided by that, but there is no need to look at the world in which we exist, the phenomenal world, as having any, you know, kind of distinctive sort of map or mapping to these principles that he's talking about. Each person, like you said, is has both these. And to experience them both in ourselves is the primary thing.
Thank you.
Devashish,
yeah.
I'm just thinking that the universe itself creates. So there's a creative principle to the universe.
Yes.
And the whole discussion of gender or sex, and I'm thinking of the two of sex as being two polarities, that the creative principle of the universe is really just, the sexes are really just poles of that principle, and the principle itself is just the tension between those two polarities. For example, the same thing would be the electromotive force between a proton and an electron.
Yes. Yeah, completely. I agree with you, Dan, because that's the way in which he's looking at it. In fact, yeah. I think this discussion, we have to look at it in that way, as polarities of the creative principle. And that's why though he does use, there becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles, whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. But here, I think, we can very safely translate that as the polarities of creation, rather than sort of get stuck in thinking of them in terms of human ideas of masculinity and femininity.
Devashish?
Yes, Owen.
I just point out one more thing that kind of came to mind. I know that when I looked at Ramakrishna, his main focus was on Kali and on the Divine Mother. That was who he really loved the most. And he seemed like he just became such a pillar of Shakti. I'm not going to say by the way that he looked physically, but kind of. I mean, when I looked at him, what I received was this like Shakti. And I think the same is true for Ramana Maharshi. But I don't know, Aurobindo is just so amazing. I kind of look at him differently. He's just in a class of his own. I don't even know how to describe how he looks. He looks so, so ancient and so powerful and so amazing. But, at any rate, I just, thought of that and, thought about the meditation that, but I guess Aurobindo probably meditated on the Divine Mother so much that I can't even begin to conceive of. But I think their relationship to these principles, these creative principles, were truly informed by their own practice and by their own deep inquiry. And that to me is a guide.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you see, when you're talking about meditation, I think the point that he's making, particularly in that long paragraph, has to do with the fact that the manifest cosmos, both in terms of its spatiality, that is, containing all the entities that lie in it, as well as in its temporality, that is, as an evolution in time, that's why the space and time aspects of the manifest cosmos. If we can think or meditate on this entire thing, with including our place in it as something that is connected to every other, as the mother. That is really the feminine principle. That is ultimately that which is giving birth, that which is creating, that which is manifesting. And within it, it has actually manifest the polarity from which it itself was, manifest. Because ultimately, as the relation, to create a space, to create a medium in which the relationship between the original polarity of Brahman can be multiplied, that is the very body of the mother.
Thank you.
For whoever's looking for a meditation on he and she, I would recommend Savitri, Book 1, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, a lot of pages written, where he toggles back and forth between he and she and uniting them mantrically.
Yeah, indeed. Matteo, I would agree. And that entire passage ends with the line, "This whole world is only he and she." I think this whole wide world is only he and she, is how he ends that passage.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Lopa, would you like to read next?
What page is it on the book?
But you don't have an...
Say it again.
This is the paragraph starting with a purely physical space.
It's 360 in the book.
360. A purely physical. Yeah. A purely physical space might be regarded as in itself a property of matter. But matter is a creation of energy in movement. Space, therefore, in the material world could be either a fundamental self-extension of material energy or its self-formed existence field, its representation of the inconscient infinity in which it is acting, a figure in which it accommodates the formulas and movements of its own action and self-creation. Time would be itself the course of that movement, or else an impression created by it, an impression of something that presents itself to us as regularly successive in its appearance, a division or a continuum upholding the continuity of movement and yet marking off its successions, because the movement itself is regularly successive. Or else time could be a dimension of space necessary for the complete action of the energy, but not understood by us as such, because it is seen by our conscious subjectivity as something itself subjective, felt by our mind, not perceived by our senses, and therefore not recognized as a dimension of space which has to us the appearance of a sense-created or sense-perceived objective extension.
So here he is turning to the physical nature of space and time. How is physical space and time manifest, and what is its what are its realities, or what is, if we look at it as one, what is its reality? And here he's giving a few possibilities. One is that it may be a property of matter, And then he's looking at matter itself as a creation of energy and movement. So if that's the case, then it is part of this movement. It's extended from this movement. And so, again, we can look at it as something that is a property of time or a dimension of time. And then he's talking about the other possibilities, that it may be a fundamental self-extension of material energy or its self-formed existence field. So he's saying that, like, just as there is an inconscient infinity, the infinity of Brahman is manifest at every level. That is exactly what Bhrigu was experiencing when he said Annam Brahma, for example. That is, matter is Brahman. So at each of these levels, the infinity of Brahman is present. And the representation, the self-representation of its own infinity at the level of matter would be Brahman. That would be space. This is another way of looking at this fundamental self-extension. Okay, so he looks at matter either as something which is a property of material space, as in matter as a property of material objects. If there are objects and they are in relation, that means whatever is facilitating that relationship or the communication between those entities is space. On the other hand, space may be the self-manifest infinity of matter, because Brahman is manifest as infinity at every level, and hence that would be one way of looking at space. It's interesting that Sri Aurobindo points to so many, I mean, there are so many ors in these paragraphs, and is he doing that because he's just looking at it philosophically as different possibilities? Is he doing that because these may be spiritual possibilities, but he's not picking between them? I don't think either of them is true. It's what he has pointed out earlier, that the self-perception of the infinite is one which is complex and infinite in itself. And so the very understanding of each one of these things could be a variety of ideas. All these ideas are true. And that's why he observes them as self-perceptions of Brahman and gives them as these ors. Again, he looks at time and shows from a certain point of view that time could be a dimension of space. But we cannot experience it like that because we don't experience the objectivity of time. We only experience the subjectivity of time. And that's why he's saying that is the awe of time as a dimension of space. And otherwise, it is the course of the movement, which is the movement of matter in space, the course of that movement, or an impression created by it. If it is only subjective, then it is only an impression created by that course of the movement. And so he's looking at, again, these are the various ways in which time and space, again, are entangled at the physical level. Each can be seen as a dimension of the other. And all these ways of looking at it, either as communication, as the dynamics, a movement, or as one, as a dimension of the other, a function of the other, these are all simultaneous truths of space and time, which manifest the Brahman at the material level. I think someone has their mic on.
Beverly, yeah, I'm just messaging her. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's read the next paragraph. It's a long, no, it's not such a long paragraph. Let's read the next paragraph. And, if there is time, we can discuss it. Otherwise, we'll discuss it next time.
Sure. This is the paragraph starting in any case, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I can go. In any case, if spirit is the fundamental reality, time and space must either be conceptive conditions under which the spirit sees its own movement of energy, or else they must be fundamental conditions of the spirit itself, which assume a different appearance or status according to the status of consciousness in which they manifest. In other words, there is a different time and space for each status of our consciousness, and even different movements of time and space within each status. But all would be renderings of a fundamental spiritual reality of time-space. In fact, when we go behind physical space, we become aware of an extension on which all this movement is based, and this extension is spiritual and not material. It is self or spirit containing all action of its own energy. This origin or basic reality of space begins to become apparent when we draw back from the physical. For then, we become aware of a subjective space extension in which mind itself lives and moves and which is other than physical space-time. And yet, there is an interpenetration, for our mind can move in its own space in such a way as to effectuate a movement also in space of matter or act upon something distant in space of matter. In a still deeper condition of consciousness, we are aware of a pure spiritual space. In this awareness, time may no longer seem to exist because all movement ceases. Or, if there is a movement or happening, it can take place independent of any observable time sequence.
So, we can take this up in greater detail next time, but here he's moving from our physical understanding of space-time to a spiritual understanding. And he's pointing out that moving from physical reality and our sensory experience of space and our mental experience of time as related to the sensory experience of space, we can move into a mental space and a mental understanding of time and space. And we can move further into a spiritual understanding of time and space, which is really as the self-extension of Brahman, Brahman's self-manifestations as extension and mutation. But these are all related to each other. And this is another very important point, because just as entities are related to each other in space and in time, here we find that realities are related to each other, or the space and time of different realities or different states of consciousness are related to each other at the individual level and at the cosmic level. And to become aware of this, that the reason, one of the reasons at least why Sri Aurobindo is discussing this, is exactly in a way what Owen was talking about, is to facilitate a meditation on the mother. This is all part of the body of the mother. The coordination of space and time at different states of consciousness of the cosmos and of the individual, and their coordination, how are they interdependent and how do they interpenetrate, how do they influence each other. That entire coordination, extremely complex, unthinkable by the mind, is yet worked out in the body of the reality, of the manifest reality, and that would be an aspect of understanding who is the mother, or who is the, or what is the Shakti.
So we'll, we'll stop at this point and continue 2 Saturdays from now.
Okay. Okay, so next we'll be convening on the 25th of July.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, so we'll continue July 25th at 7:30.
Yes.
I'll stop the call now and stop the recording as well.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Debbie. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Thanks, all. Thank you, Debbie.
Bye-bye.
Bye.